We went through page 168 last time. And this end of this chapter and the next chapter kind of builds on what we've done. So I thought I'd just do a quick review of where we've come, try to put it in context. It can get a little confusing, but I think if we can see a thread of development, it'll be a lot easier to stomach. Kind of a pickup point might be where we talked about page 157, 158, what it meant to become conscious of these various elements, the shadow, the anima and animus, and the self, or rather the projections of the shadow, the projections of the anima and animus, and the projections of the self. Remember, these rules of thumb are very dangerous, but because you might think, well, it's got to be this way, no. But just to kind of give you a touch, when you're dealing with shadow projection, it's somebody you don't like, usually of your own sex. Morning.
Morning.
We just got started. When you're dealing with the anima or animus, it's a positive feeling tone onto usually an opposite sex figure, but the key is where there's eros. And the self, again, has a positive thrust to it, and this is quite simplistic, but you could think of it as idealized figures. Sports, and these are almost collective, sports figures, politicians, heroes. You know, we've got a bad dose of it. You just go to the movies. Every movie is about a hero. If you go to European movies, they're about a slice of life. So we have this terrific need to see the savior outside of ourselves. That would be a self-projection. Then we started talking about, or she started talking about, I would put it like this, how do we conceptualize what it is to withdraw a projection? What's the process? What happens when you do? And to make this clear, she works with an image. Like a good Jungian, that image is the mirror. Why the mirror? Because the mirror reflects. So we'll be talking about the nature of reflection. So 160, she introduced the idea that the mirror symbolizes our ability to reflect. You know, how did I get into that experience? What was of myself was I seeing in that person? That's mirroring the situation, reflecting on the situation. And the folks who can't do it, you might very well see they dream of broken mirrors. And they simply can't understand how they get into the messes they get into. They can't reflect. So what we try to do is build up that capacity to reflect. She then adds something very interesting, I thought, which was that if we are able to reflect, we do so because the self supports that process. How does the self get to support that process? By our reflecting on a situation, as we reflect on the unconscious begins to reflect on us. She then goes to the idea of return from the I Ching, that these insights into a projection are returns, meaning you're coming back into a part of yourself that you've lost. I think that's where the aha comes from in these moments. It takes effort to reflect, but ultimately, the insight that comes is grace. As we reflect on our unconscious projections, that sets up a parallel process in the unconscious which reflects on us. You might say, as we see it, it begins to see us. And the image that she talks about that represents the unconscious seeing us is the eye, E-Y-E. And we'll see much more of this as we go through the remaining pages. Then she spends a fair amount of time on the symbolism of the eye, that there is something in us seeing us. And that what we try to do is see the point of view of the eye in us that's seeing us. I don't know if that makes sense, but we try to put ourselves in its position so that we get a more accurate view of who we really are. That led to a segue, which we'll pick up more today, on this I is both personal and collective. It's both personal and social. We'll talk more about that. One thing we skipped over, I'll just allude to it, I realize we skipped over, was this business of absolute knowledge on the bottom of 167. And the idea is that there is objective knowledge. Now, if you say that in a philosophy class today, you'll get assassinated. Because the fashion of the day is postmodernism, which says everything is a point of view. In a way, they have a point. What Jung is saying is there is objective knowledge in us, but we don't always know it. Our knowledge of the objective knowledge is subjective. And where do you see the objectivity of the knowledge? And this would be something I'd love to talk to a modern philosopher about. I believe it's in the body. When objective knowledge is not known, it attacks the body. The classic example you probably heard me talk about was that, remember the boy with the eczema that made a frown? Did you all hear that?
Yeah.
It's a very, I guess you haven't, Margaret, it's a very quick thing I'll just relate. This Dan McGuire, a dermatologist, who sadly is deceased now, worked with dermatological disturbances. That's another whole issue. But from the Jungian point of view. And she told it the case where she had a young boy brought in, and he had eczema, or psoriasis, I think, that formed a frown down his face. And it looked to her as if it were a clown's mask frowning. In probing the family situation, to make a long story short, there was a great deal of sadness in that family that was not being addressed. His body knew that. When that sadness in the family was resolved, his psoriasis went away. So that would be an example, I think, of objective knowledge. Something is, there is something going on. You probably also heard me tell my story about this woman who was in postmodern couple counseling, and her husband was just awful, and I got him into counseling, bad choice of counselors, who was, I didn't realize it, sort of this always, well, it's her point of view and his point of view. Every time there was an argument, well, she reacted that way because of her upbringing, and he reacted that way because of his upbringing. And I was trying to get across, no, he's a sadist, and he's abusing her. Well, one day he punched her in the face. I wanted to say to the counselor, now, whose experience was that? That there is really something going on. So this objective knowledge causes a lot of trouble both in psychology and philosophy. And it certainly is dangerous when you think you've got the truth. And I think that's the value of owning up to, oh, this is my point of view. This is how I see it. And yet, on the other hand, sometimes there are simply things that are going on. We'll come back to that later in the book, and it's another example that would be synchronicity. That somehow we don't know what's going on, but it's as if there is a knowledge in objective events about our condition. So just to have mentioned that word, and to know it's not very fashionable.
Is science play in here with objective knowledge, that they are attempting to be objective in discovering how the world operates?
I think a real scientist would say no, that they create models. And they're quite willing to recognize that model may be inadequate. That the model which works now may not work in 50 years for more facts that have been discovered. You know, another way to put objective knowledge is that there's a knowing apart from consciousness. I think, you know, you would certainly find scientists who would say, well, you know, psychology, that's a soft science. But we are dealing with facts.
As they know them at the moment.
Then they don't, as they know them at the moment. And as they fit a pattern that is constructed at the moment. Yeah. I think, so that's pretty much where we, the other thing we did, I just wanted to refer to, I must thank you for your help in this, Snow White and the Mirror. I finally figured out why the mirror says you are the fairest, you are not the fairest, because she's not looking at a projection. The idea that von Franz is working with is when we are attentive to our projections, then the unconscious is attentive to us. And when we are not, the mirroring function of the unconscious can't be established. Now, remember, fairy tales, at least as von Franz works with them, are collective stories. They depict shifts in consciousness in a collective sense. So that the way I understood Snow White, now in light of our discussion, is that that story was talking about the shift to the beginning of the ability to reflect on projections. So there was a time when humanity could not do that. Look at the witch burnings and so on. But slowly this ability to realize the psyche out there belongs in here emerged in a historical sense, and that may be what the fairy tale is about. So I just want to throw that out. Okay. A lot of what I just said we're going to repeat from now to the end of the book, just from different angles, and then slowly build on it. So that's what she does on 169. The possibility of integrating projections, projected contents, the possibility of integrating projected contents instead of apotropaically, meaning protecting yourself, casting them out into extra psychic space, does not arise until symbols of the self begin to appear. That's what I just said. And that is just a transition. Now she starts on an idea that is going to be followed up through pages of recollecting ourselves into a unity. Hence the title of the book. In other words, these parts were once inside us, as babies, as children, slowly through the process of education and adaption to reality, we lose much of ourselves. When we lose it, it forms projections in the outer world, and what we're about as adults or quasi-adults is bringing these projections back into a center so that we reconstruct the self. Now, Jung has, I think I figured it out once, four different models of the self, how you establish a relationship with the self. This is what I would call the Gnostic model. We'll talk more about Gnosticism in a second. Where you reconstruct it, or you might say you bring back your pieces, and when those pieces are lodged in you again, they of their own accord form a new center. Another model would be the alchemical model, where you are crucified between opposites and the self is the third that emerges in their synthesis.
like the secret of the golden flower, where the,
yeah.
all the parts come
yeah.
out,
right.
and then it comes back and
right.
forms the garden.
But I call that the alchemical model.
Okay.
Because there's a split, and then there's a union. But I guess you could say Gnostic as well.
Okay.
If you see all those pieces out there. The other is the answer to Job, where you stand against the destructive impact of the unconscious, and that activates the inner self. There's a fourth, but I can't think of it.
I was trying to remember these two.
I've only talked about it about 20 times. It might be the hero myth, where he really doesn't have the self yet, but he talks about standing against the unconscious. But just so you're aware, there are different ways to talk about the self stuff. This is just one of them. And then on the bottom of that page, he gives a great description of what it's like to not have everything related. Compartment psychology. One thing, one moment, one thing, the next. Politics is a great place to watch that. And then she kind of makes a little excursion on 170 into how does consciousness develop. And she just talks about the first emergence of consciousness is spasmodic. Before that, there were flashing moments, and then she says, the middle of that second paragraph, 170, a continuous memory. That is in even, I think all psychologists would agree, that the definition of the ego is what provides continuous memory. Not for crazy people, they don't have that. Today they were, like John was saying, yesterday they were Joe Smith, today they're Jesus Christ. And it never occurs to them as a contradiction. Okay, that's all kind of background. Now she goes into Gnosticism. Is everyone aware of the use Jung made of Gnosticism? No. Yes, 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 no. Very quick. Gnosticism was a competing theological position, probably pre-Christian, certainly took hold in the birth of Christianity, which had a different interpretation of events of Christ. And in the Gnostic idea, God, at the creation of the world, got lost in the world. Little pieces of God got stuck in matter, so that matter is made up of divinity broken up into teensy little pieces. And what the Gnostics, and so the creation of the world, you see, was a loss for God. God became diminished because in creating the world, he got trapped in it. And the parts of God trapped in the world long for God. And the religious task of the Gnostic is to live so that when he dies or she dies, a piece of God in him or her goes back to God. So that God, it's God who needs redemption, not people. And the individual's relationship to that process is the most important thing. As you can see, where's the church in that? Nowhere. So the church says, that's a heresy. And this then became an underground current within the Christian tradition. But why Jung liked it so much is he took that as an image of the selves getting dissolved in the world and our need to bring back the pieces of ourself in our projection, so that our projections would be like those little pieces of light that are scattered throughout the world. And as we bring those back into ourselves, the self gets stronger like in the Gnostic model, God gets redeemed by pieces of him going back to himself. Sometimes it's God, sometimes it's Sophia. It, you know, there's a gazillion different varieties of that basic structure. But that's what she does on the 170-171. And I guess apparently other traditions that I'm not all that familiar with, she refers to the Stoics, Greek philosophy, had similar ideas. But it doesn't matter. The basic idea is how this thing works. Are you okay so far?
Where are you with the Stoics?
Stoics, you're on 170.
Sparks there,
right? Well, they picked a great word.
I do think of you, Jordan.
Maybe that's why I like this.
Yeah.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
It's painting of Jordan.
I was just reminding her,
oh.
Like her painting, like the little sparks.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those images that once you're alerted to it, it appears not infrequently in dreams. And in hidden ways, like, you know, you may realize you're digging your garden and you find a bunch of monkey gold.
A bunch of what?
Monkey gold. Or what do they call that? That's what we call that in Pennsylvania.
Pyrite?
Fool's gold. Yeah. Okay. Those. You never heard that before? Oh, that must be Pennsylvania. Yeah, little specks. Or you see somebody and they have on makeup that's sparkly, you know. It really does appear. And apparently in some modern artists. Yeah. Yeah. So, now, that is the bridge to some more reflection on page 172. We're going to go a little slower. Because it is the bridge to her expanding or developing Jung's expanded idea of what the self is. That the self is not only personal, it's also collective. So I'm going to read here for about two or three paragraphs. These Stoic and Gnostic texts reveal two trains of thought to the attentive reader. That would be us. First, the individual human contains in itself various kinds of sparks, the sparks of collective representations, and must gather them into a unity in variations, and must even gather light sparks in the outer world. Second, now this is the interesting thing, I think. The spiritual souls of men, or of certain chosen men, are themselves sparks that are gathered up by a God-man and Redeemer figure and brought back into unity with God or with the divine world. Translated into psychological language, the first process depicts how a human being gathers or collects himself through meditation and, for example, with the aid of his dreams, becomes conscious of his complexes and projections, and in this way develops into a spiritually and morally more integrated and more whole personality. As is well known, Jung named this process individuation process. The self stands, says Jung, in a creative relationship to the ego, and at the same time the individual being in the form in which the self becomes manifest. The recollecting or gathering together of the divine light substance in the Gnostic and Manichaeism corresponds psychologically to the integration of the self through the bringing split off contents into consciousness. Nothing totally new there yet, but the mythologem cited above, however, depicts a process of recollecting that proceeds from the God-man or the light-man or some similar anthropos, be like the original Adam, anthropos, redeemer figure, and that unites the many single human souls into unity, that is, into a genuine community. So they're taking the self from an inner process to something that is the basis of community. That what we are integrating in our personal self is an aspect of humanity that we all share. and this is what can lead to genuine community. Therefore, not only does the individual become whole, a whole in himself, but a community comes into being that also represents a whole. You know, when you see this in dreams, or I have, it's always struck me, and again, as I've mentioned, it's not something that I think Jung has talked a whole lot about, for probably for good reasons, but when people reach a certain level of development, the dreams turn to telling them to start sharing what they've learned. As if the inner process is not only inner. It immediately plugs them back into social life. I remember, you know, one woman who was going through a difficult relationship with her husband and was in marriage therapy. They make considerable progress on resolving the difficulty. Immediately, as soon as they started getting along better, she dreamt they had to go to the local pub and sit down with other couples who were having difficulty and share what they learned. That came out of the dream. So you see how the unconscious plugs us right back in. Another person had learned sort of a creative skill, and right away, as that became less, you know, more accepted by her, she dreamt she was knocking down rooms around her dining room, bringing people in to share with them what they learned. So this I find very fascinating, that particularly since we live in a time where everybody's so damn selfish, that you think the self would make you more inward. It does for a while, but then it brings you out again. I think that's what she's getting at. Anyone figure out why Jung didn't talk about that? I have a thought, but why did Jung emphasize the inner aspect of selfhood so much?
I think, you know, to individuate, as you individuate, then you end up serving the self. So you need like a certain mass of people doing that before you can kind of develop this second collective community in a way.
Yeah. That may be true. I don't think that's why you're kind of onto something, but in reverse. Well, I'll tell you my thought. It's just an opinion. It had to do with the war. That Jung saw so much collectivist behavior in World War I and World War II that he said, we've got to stop joining groups and become individuals. We, on the other hand, I'm happy when somebody returns a phone call. We've gotten so other, so oriented away from others that I think now it's appropriate to talk about this other aspect of the self, because we've gone to the other extreme.
It was just a thing on NPR this morning about one of the people was, you know, reading his article about, you know, how many years ago there was a protest against the horrible working conditions of migrant farmers in the U.S. and people quit buying lettuce and grapes, you know, and now, like, the conditions in Chile and other places where, you know, this food comes from are horrendous, you know, and you do nothing, you know. So mm-hmm. I think that, and, you know, we see these movies about Rwanda, you know, but and how horrible the conditions were, and we cry, but like when it was actually happening, people were like, well, what can we do? You know, mm-hmm. nothing. Yeah. So I think that's exactly the point. That yeah. I mean, things are so incredibly out of control mm-hmm. in the world that, you know, we've got to start taking mm-hmm. this back, you know, and yeah. take some sort of action. And it'd be something about, I mean, just the, you know, working conditions in China. We buy these laptops, and they're made by people who, you know, work in, you know, conditions that would disgust you if, yeah. if you saw it.
Yeah. Do you know what it costs to manufacture an iPhone? A friend of mine who deals in it told me.
$10.
$7.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Because it's made in China.
Mm-hmm. Or, China. So, yeah, or Thailand or someplace. Yeah. Yeah. So what interests me, whether this will ever have any effect in reality, I don't know. You can see how the unconscious natively cares about the other person. And we've been taught, haven't we, that we're naturally selfish, and through Christ we become generous. Mm-hmm. But I think that's so bogus, that there really is a nature has in it a caring for the other person. And it's not a should, it's not a morality, it's simply a natural generosity. Okay. That's right. There's a, you want to go back in that, yeah, or the bathroom, either way. Or to your left. Her brother's in the hospital. So, yeah, so what she's playing with, she's interpreting that myth, that what is integrated is a, in these myths, is a figure that does not belong to one person only. It belongs to a community. And look at the top of 172. Top line, to the extent...
173.
Sorry, 173. To the extent that each individual relates to the self in himself, he will quite naturally assume his rightful place in a social order of a psychological kind. And then Kathy mentioned that beautiful... I was going to get that. Maybe I will do that. I'll do that after the break. In we did The Living Symbol. It's a book by Gerhard Adler, which is a case study of one woman. And in the latter part of the work, she has a flower, and she's carrying the flower, and then she sees a mosaic with an empty spot, and her flower fits exactly in it. I think that's profound.
But that flower went through a lot of transformation. Whole journey to be able to fit into that
right.
spot.
Well said. Yeah, she first she got the flower, and then she's going to leave it in the underworld, wasn't she? Mm-hmm. So she makes this journey down, and she has the flower, and then she comes back up, and she leaves the flower down below. And the way they worked with it was she was having insights, but she didn't want to feel what was being asked of her in terms of sharing on a human scale what those insights involved. So she had to then recover that flower and went through all sorts of hell recovering it, and then finally she could put it in. I think that's just, again, if you think about it, if you take dreams seriously, that there is a place for you. There is a place for us. And part of our work is not only developing that self, but then finding that place in the world where that self is meant to fit. And somehow that place is a priori. And then she goes on a little bit more about that idea is not all that different from the body of Christ. Again, not talking literally, but saying other traditions have had this idea of a place for us in a larger framework, in a larger spiritual, social framework. And all this is involved with the coming to consciousness of the self. Projections are withdrawn. That reflecting on our projections activates the inner eye, EYE, which reflects on us. And part of the nature of that eye is it represents something in us that has a pre-existent place in the world that we are to fit into.
Projections don't stop at that point, though, right?
Because no.
There's a continual growing and learning about yourself
yeah.
in the world.
So. Remember, the idea is that the shadow, in theory, I've never achieved it, I don't know anyone who has, can be integrated. The anima and animus never. That they will always be creating mischief and creating another fascination for you to contemplate concerning where your life could go. That the future of your life comes to you through the images presented in Eros. And the self, likewise, I mean, this, you can see that what I just said, the anima and animus is working on behalf of the self. Because it is showing you where your greater life can evolve to. And until you die, hopefully, you're always evolving. And then the self is not integrated until death. So that neither of those, anima, animus, or the self, are totally integratable until death. And maybe not even then.
The anima and animus often work for your inferior function?
Usually, what you'll be, if you have made your main functions conscious, then the anima and animus will be of the type of your inferior function. So if you're a thinker, you'll be attracted to feelers. If you're sensate, you'll be attracted to intuitives. If you're an intuitive, you'll be attracted to sensates, and so on. But again, remember, top of the bell curve, that there can be any variety of permutations there. How's he doing? Good. Well, this might be a place we've been talking about. Miriam, I think we have a little show and tell. We have a little show and tell?
Yeah, a couple things. I don't know where you are right now, but this...
Oh, we just talked about the self. We referred back to the... remember in the living symbol where she puts the flower in the mosaic and there was a place for it?
Yes.
We talked about how what we generate in the self then has a place in the world, a pre-existing place in the world.
Okay. I don't know that much about Hinduism, and I don't even know that this is a Hindu piece, so if anybody has any ideas, but it has the idea to me of the roundness of the center of the self, and all these reflections, all these little mirrors all around it, it's a center one. But then it's done in square, which I thought was very symbolic of some kind of understanding coming together, collecting all these little sparks of the mirrors.
Beautiful. Yeah. There's something very astounding. Compare that to a Christian mantra. What's at the center of a Christian mantra?
A cross.
And what's at the center of this mantra? A mirror. So you don't see God, you see yourself. That's amazing, I think. That may be the difference. And then those little pieces would be little pieces that you are withdrawing them into the center. If we, you know, if we interpret in our model.
Mm-hmm. Well, they form a pattern too. I mean, there's a lot of pattern in that. Mm-hmm. And it's the pattern of who you are, then it's pulled together.
Where did you get this?
My mother-in-law, when she passed away, there were several things in the house, and this is one of the things that I chose.
So we don't know where it came from for sure, huh?
No.
Well, it'd be nice to know.
Yeah, I will ask them, because I think they may have gone to India at one point in time. They did travel with friends.
Would you know an East Asian art specialist that you can run that by? I'm very curious. That mirror is astounding, I think, that a tradition would put a mirror in the place where you can hardly find a mandala that does not have God in the center. Mm-hmm. But here you've got a mirror. And Jung made that observation that in his seeing mandalas of patience, where traditional mandalas put God, they put themselves. And he felt that was an enormously important development. In other words, the individuation or reflection has become the new form of worship. So that's why I'm so curious about where it did come from. It looks Hindu to me, but
yeah, it
it's too complicated to be Buddhist, wouldn't you think? I don't know enough about Buddhism to give an evaluation, but...
I don't know. I have some Buddhist textbooks that are very complicated.
Very complicated?
Are they? Okay.
I would be curious.
I don't know. Maybe someone at the IMA would know. Mm-hmm.
They must have East Asian specialists there.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm touched. That mirror in the center, I think, is astounding. I just got a movie from Netflix, which I didn't watch, but I just kind of fast-forwarded to see if I want to keep it. I'm watching French movies, for my French, and there's just one scene. I remember this woman's in a club, and she pulls out her compact, and a guy comes up, and he says to her, "Sorry, madam, we don't allow mirrors in here." If you've ever read Sartre's, what's it called in English? Oui clos in French. You know, where they're down in hell,
Well, I just watched that.
What's it called in English?
I don't know.
Anyway, they're in hell, and there's no mirror. That's one of the characteristics of hell, is there's no mirror. They can't see themselves, and they're going crazy because they can't reflect. Yeah. I'll think of it if I don't think of it. You would know the title. Kind of a classic from the 50s. So, thank you. Do we want to show and tell the other pictures?
This was just for people to look at because we were talking about Remedios Varos.
Does she have any mirrors in her pictures?
I don't know. I'll look at the brain.
Okay. We can always have show and tell. So I find this astounding that self-work isn't completed until you find that a priori place in the world which has been made for you. That is one of the implications of Jung's concept of the self, which really has not, he's mentioned it certainly, but he's not developed it in any thorough way. Well, she kind of repeats a little bit then, the bottom of 173, well, the second paragraph of 173, this dual motif of the process of gathering. I just think that's a nice phrase, that creating the self is both an inner and an outer process.
Wonderful poem by Miguel de Unamuno that just reminds me of this process.
Yes, tell us.
He says, shake off this sadness and recover your spirit. Oh, well, wait, I will mention, one thing he mentions is the work. If he doesn't mean like work like a job, he means work like this work. So in the poem, he talks about work. He says, shake off this sadness and recover your spirit. Sluggish, you will never see the wheel of fate as it brushes your heel as it turns going by. The one who wants to live is the one in whom life is abundant. Now you are only giving food to that final pain which is slowly winding you in the nets of death. But to live is to work. The only thing that lasts is the work. Turn then, turn to the work. Throw yourself like seed into the furrow and into your own field. And do not turn your face, for that would be to turn it towards death. And do not let the past weigh down your motion. Leave what's alive in the furrow, what's dead in yourself. For life does not move in the same way as a group of clouds, and from your work, one day, you will be able to gather yourself.
Wow.
Miguel de Unamuno.
He's South American or Spanish?
I want to say he's either Spanish or Portuguese or something.
Mm-hmm.
Could you spell that? D-U-N-O-M-U-N-O.
Yeah.
Does that poem have a title?
Throw yourself like seed.
Ooh, that's powerful. Yeah. And you're a poet. You're like, when you tell it. Very moving.
Yeah. I love them. When I feel bad, I recite poems in my head to myself. Mm-hmm. It really helps. Yeah. To know them by heart is helpful, I think.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's it, all right.
Yeah, how old that poem is, you know, 50 or 100 years old, and he's talking about this
process. Yeah. Well, that is summed up, 174, second paragraph. Now, the first stage shows the process of the inner unification of the personality and the individuation process. The second stage, however, has reference to a special process that always accompanies individuation in the single person, namely the development of relatedness to certain fellow human beings and to mankind as a whole, a relatedness that proceeds not from the ego, but from a transcendental inner center of the self.
You're both going on at the same time on some level, it's not as clean as this. You do the one and then you do the other.
That's a darn good question. I got to figure that out.
Okay. If you were to look back at all your dreams through the individuation process, would there be little sparks of that second part that
would be there, little images of it.
I would tend to say, more you first go in, and then you go out, because I think the great temptation of being out, I think we just saw this in the death of Whitney Houston, is you become what you are expected to be, and then you kill yourself. That pool must be so terribly seductive that you have to go through a period of withdrawal to find that inner voice. But I think, certainly in my case, as I look back over my life, what I thought were utterly unrelated chapters. I've lived in the Orient, I've studied theology, I've studied psychology, studied science. Am I just nuts or what? But now all those parts are required for my interests, which have come to me from the outside. So there I think you can see that that inner process is anticipating that outer position, but you don't know it. And I'm almost tempted to say you shouldn't know it, because the seduction... See, the other problem with the fact that there's a mirror there and not God is... you don't discern where the reflection's coming from. That's why I think we have these reality shows. See, that's the eye. That's the eye of God. Mm-hmm. And people are a slave to it. So that's probably not a full answer, but it's an attempt to go around your question.
Well, I wonder, too. I mean, we're going to get into the whole idea of synchronicity later on in the outer world.
Right.
Changing as well, and I'm just wondering about the interplay of these two processes. There's something going on in the outer world as well as you're changing on the inner, so that somewhere they both meet.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
I think that quote by Victor Hugo that I shared with you, I'll have to find that where those two meet, and that's what you hope for.
Yeah, do find that, if you would. Okay. Yeah. What I find so interesting here is there's two threads, as she said. There's a dual process. There's my development. And then... there is that place in the world that requires my development, and when I'm ready to give it, the place in the world opens up. So has there been a development all along, moving toward me, this way, and then I'm moving this way, and they meet? And if that's the case, what's the nature of history that can happen? What's the nature of history that there is a place for us? And there might even be a place for us being prepared that meets us when we get there. And this, of course, Jung really didn't explore. But this is why I'm interested in Toynbee. He did explore that. And so that the extroverted dimension of the self opens up huge questions about what is history and how apparently it's not just random. As we saw in Carol's painting, for example, something in her unconscious knew of the Arab Spring, what, a year? 2 years in advance. How far?
2007 it was made, I think.
So 5 years in advance. 4 years in advance. Yeah. And, if you take... I've been reading some history books because for this time and stuff. None of these guys talk like this. Everything is like, well, it's an economic cause and an economic result. And this mineral was discovered here, which created this trade here and caused that there. But that could all just be ephemeral, and there might be something else going on. So it just raises questions, which I find very exciting. Particularly since we live in a time of historical mess. Maybe this can add some insight to what we're dealing with. I don't know, but it's more interesting than doing nothing.
The problem is so much of the history kind of gets, stuck into this idea of, continual progress and evolution, which kind of puts the linear cast to it.
But there might be progress. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have the tools yet to see what is really going on shaping history. We know how people's lives are shaped, but do we know how our entire race or our entire world is shaped from the inside, so that outer events are merely popping ups of a, I don't know what word to use, collective individuation process or what? What is it, cyclical? Is it linear? Is it spiral? Who knows? I find that exciting. Okay. Then she takes a little detour to a dream, which I thought was pretty amazing. Her point now, see, she's shifting her focus, and her focus is going to shift from now to the end of the book, just so you're aware. If you haven't noticed, you're not paying attention. Because she's going to what is the larger dimension of the self, which we've just reconstructed, and which that whole book has been showing us facets of. Well, an aspect of selfhood, she is saying, is that it's shared among people. And when two people come into a genuine loving encounter, that's what's involved. That's what she's doing here, is just an example of what I was talking about between two people. I was talking about it to history, but this idea that our involvement in the world is based on a deeper principle, and that whether that's one individual or whether that's a society, it doesn't matter. It's the same idea. I know you probably understood this dream, but I'm tempted to go through it sentence by sentence because it's so rich. Maybe just touching on a couple of points as we do. I'm with my teacher, an invisible presence. Remember we talked about the self as guide? See, here's classic example of the self. On the edge of a sphere, which you described as the ultimate reality. Try telling that to a postmodernist. Something timeless and spaceless, indescribable, only those who have seen it can describe this experience, and all nothing, and everywhere nowhere, and everybody nobody, as the word which has not yet been spoken. Somehow, the teacher helped me pull two beings or something out of this ultimate reality. I think that's the first big thing, that what a human relationship is, it's a particularization of a shared infinity between the two people. I mean, I don't know how else to do it except use that kind of language. I did not see them, but I knew about them. In order to make them visible, the teacher helped me to pull a silver gray cloud-like material out of the space in which we were suspended. We clothed the two beings in it, and a third something which separated the two. As soon as I saw them clothed, a deep amazement fell over me. "Those are angels," I cried out. "Yes," he answered, "that's what you are." And then she's going to refer to this in a second. I think you've all seen this picture probably many times, right? Where a relationship of two is a relationship of two, and then two more, four. So this would then would be that, this would be that, that invisible cloud. Now this is one of the things I find so amazing here. "Those are angels," I cried out. "Yes," he answered, "that's what you are." I saw the gray curtain which separated the two angels, and the teacher explained, "That is the veil of illusion. It had many holes." I was deeply moved and called out, "Oh, it's going away, it's going away." Here's the punchline. And I felt that thousands of years that had been lived in the half-conscious hope that it could be broken through were now fulfilled. What I understand there is, and I hope this is not just arrogance, that really for the first time in history, we are living in an age when men and women can relate to each other. I mean, Doris Day and John Wayne did not have a relationship. Now, that idealization, that role definition has been shattered. And I think for all the crap we're going through, it's a beautiful compensation.
It's also the point of meditation. Like in meditation, that's the point that you see through that. You know, so like on a, it happens, I think, collectively and then also individually. You know, that's the Buddhist psychology that we see through that veil of Maya, the illusion.
I wonder if that's not happening socially as well. I even think in my generation, we are still under the spell of that veil. Mm-hmm. Folks who are like 10 years older than me, guys, they still talk about women like sex objects. It's gross. They're fraternity and they're getting laid in their fraternities. I mean, these are 60, 70 year old men talking like boys. You don't hear 22 year old guys talking like that anymore. There's a level of shared respect that I think is new. And I find that very encouraging. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to go into this, that we really are part of a bigger picture as we relate. And if that bigger picture is there, it's worth sticking out. If that bigger picture isn't there, it's not worth sticking out. I went to the angel, who was I, and I saw a silver cord stretching down from him to a tiny creature who was also I in the world of illusion. So that would be the fourth. Another cord went down to a woman down below. It was Alberta, the woman he loved. So he was in a triangle. The two angels appeared to be identical. They were sexless, and they could think together in a kind of identity. This has sometimes happened to Alberta and me in the reality down below. And we thought, such a small part of our consciousness lives in these little creatures, and they worry so much about such little things. Poor little creatures. We saw that their union could only happen really rightly, another big thing, I think, if the two little creatures met their obligations to their families and relatives and did not pursue their egotistic desires. And at once, it was clear to us that it would be a sin against the ultimate reality, sin against the Holy Ghost, if we did not go ahead in the process of reciprocal coming to consciousness. How'd you like to have that dream?
Yeah. When you're so much for happily ever after.
So much for happily ever after.
Just goes to show you, you know, your destiny might not have anything to do with being happy.
Yeah. I think we can bet on it.
I'm not that negative. But.
Well, but that there is there is meant to be complication, mm-hmm. because a deeper reality is there, and it plays by different rules than we play.
And you can be joyful without being happy, which I think is the more important thing.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that's where the joy is. You know.
Well, I guess I'm thinking more about getting what you want.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you can be joyful without getting anything that you want. It's possible.
Now, living meaning becomes more important than the egotistical wants. Hopefully, yeah.
And what I also think is important here is how individual personal responsibility is stressed. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to think, I have this wonderful experience, I don't have to worry about these details. But I always go back to that Bob Dylan quote, you know, to break the law, you've got to be honest. And this guy obviously was being challenged with that insight. He had a choice for an infinite experience, but with terrific personal responsibility.
I think the conflict really there, the dream shows him that this is his actual soulmate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet he's being told not to be with his soulmate.
Mm-hmm. Is he?
Yes. He says he's got to
give her up.
Oh, I didn't feel that.
Two creatures meet their obligations to their families and relatives and did not pursue their egoistic desires. I mean, you've got to quit having sex with her.
How do you know his sex is egotistic?
That's what the dream says.
It doesn't say that.
Well, it says meet his obligations to his family.
Well, maybe he could meet his obligations to his family and have that relationship.
I think what she was saying about this couple was that they had not decided, they were struggling with whether, oh, they had already begun a sexual relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I missed that.
They were considering divorcing the present partner.
Yeah, but see, in the process of reciprocal coming to consciousness, I don't think that could happen if they weren't having a relationship.
And who says they have to give up the friendship that's supporting?
Right, who says they have to give up the sex?
Right.
That's what I get out of it. That it's not a fixed program, that whatever course of action would lead to coming to consciousness, it might mean giving up the sex, or it might mean not giving up the sex.
And could it be that their relationship allows them to be more fully in their lives so that they can meet their responsibilities?
Right.
Who's to say?
Yeah. I mean, I noticed Bonifaz did not tell us what they did.
Yeah.
And so I see it as an open issue. But whatever it is, whatever the practical conclusions that are drawn, you see you're up against a reality you can't fudge. So if to have an affair is to serve that spirit, they have to have an affair. If it is not to have an affair, they have not to have an affair. And I think that... Yeah.
What seems to be clear is it's against what their egos want.
Yeah.
Whatever it was that they wanted was what it was not
going to be. Yeah, it was a sacrifice, for sure.
It was going to be a sacrifice.
They could not spend their lives together on some level.
Yeah.
Or maybe every level. We don't know, because we don't know.
Mm-hmm. But it just shows you, that I think, the power behind some of these connections. And it's so easy, you know, and I think in our age of promiscuity, just to say, oh, well, do whatever you feel like. But there is a spirit that you have to attend to. And it may say go for it, or it may say don't go for it.